Okay, once again, welcome to the English Writing and Composition class for the upper grades. So, I'd just like to say at the start, if we're going to take an IQ test to start with, if it's too high, you have to go to a different class. So, I'm the expert in here. No, actually, I don't have an IQ test prepared, but if anything comes up that I made a mistake in my what I'm presenting, or you have something to add or subtract, feel free at any time. Most of you are teachers, so you can just talk or raise your hand. So what makes good writing? And what makes a good writer? I don't know what you're expecting when you came to this class, and I wasn't very sure either what to expect. Who are great writers? What does it take to make a great writer? Those are some questions. Because if we're writing, just like everything else, and I'll say this again later, but if we are writing, we should never be a good writer. We should certainly never think of ourselves as a good writer. We should always be a better writer. Try to be a better writer. Otherwise, we will become sloppy and boring. That is just an opinion, I suppose. But. And what we looked at earlier, the things that you study through a lot of school and what you're teaching a lot of times in English classes, like the parts of speech and punctuation, are very, very helpful in this stage of the game here. And remember that our job as teachers is to make things interesting and to keep things simple as much as we can. That applies to writing. George Orwell, who I do not necessarily agree with on all basic points, said that the scrupulous writer will ask himself the following questions for every sentence that he writes. Number one, what am I trying to say? That's the first thing for every sentence. Number two, what words will express what I'm trying to say? Number three, what image or idiom will make it clearer? More than just words. Number four, is this image fresh enough to have an effect? Original. Right? Writing, our writing, and this will come up again later, should be original, fresh. And the things that we use to present it. And then some other things you said to think about could be added to this. Could I put it more shortly? Keep it simple, right? And have I said, number six, have I said anything that is avoidably ugly? So have I said anything that is avoidably ugly? All right, again, maybe tired of me saying this, especially if you sat in any of the other classes. Make things interesting and keep them simple. Mark Twain said about writers writing sentences, at times he may indulge himself with a long one, but he will make sure that there are no folds in it, no vagueness, no parenthetical interruptions of its view as a whole. When he is done with it, it won't be a sea serpent with half of its arches under the water. It will be a torchlit procession. Now, along with keeping things simple, sometimes children's stories or children's books are a good way that a lot of information gets packed into a small, simple package. I do have a story. I don't know how much time I'll have to read things. I have a few things to read. I do want to read one here, and in this particular version happens to be a little golden book. This story has been told many times for centuries. And this story has been told in many different ways. It's been told in paintings. It's been told in statues. It's been told in poems. In fact, I almost switched and read the poem, a poem about this instead. But I didn't. And it is the Pied Piper. How many of you know the story of the Pied Piper? All right. So this is one version of it. And I'd like you to think about a story. Because in a story, you should have certain things happening if you're going to write a story, right? Writing is different. You could write stories. You can write essays, informative or persuasive. You can write poetry. And there are some common threads, but there are some differences as well. And a story is best if we've got a problem to solve, right? And we have a problem. We have a conflict, something in there that needs to be solved. And it builds on itself until it hits a climax. Something has to happen. And then and a resolution that something does happen. Sometimes the best stories do not have a very, very clear resolution. And maybe not the resolution that we'd like, right? So, with that in mind, keep those things in mind. A good story should have a good point. Sometimes a good story is good just for sake of a good story, right? But generally, even in some of the simplest stories, there's a simple truth to be learned from. All right. The town of Hameln, which is a real town in Germany, lay along the bank of a wide river. Its twisting streets were lined with the comfortable houses of the happy people who lived there. Life had gone on peacefully and pleasantly in Hameln for as long as anyone could remember. And then, one day, rats began to appear. At first, there were only a few, and no one minded very much. There's one. IQ's too high, you have to leave. Sorry. Just... In fact, the town's cats couldn't have been happier. But the rats multiplied, and soon there were more rats than townsfolk. The rats were everywhere. And one of the beautiful things about children's books that you don't get to enjoy right now is all the pictures, right? Right. That's one reason they can be simpler sometimes in their wording. After a while, folks didn't even feel safe in their own homes. The rats ate everything they could find. Sometimes people were awakened in the middle of the night by rats about to nibble their toes. Finally, the people of Hameln were at their wits' end. Off they marched to the town hall to see the mayor. The mayor was a greedy man. He cared a great deal about money, but very little about Hameln's citizens. "The rats are eating us out of house and home," cried an angry woman in the crowd. The mayor told the townspeople to be patient. He was doing all he could to help. "Get rid of the rats, and soon, or we will get rid of you," shouted the town's banker. The mayor was upset. Later, when he met with his council members, one of them said, "We've tried poison and traps, but we haven't caught any rats." "Well, think of something that will work," the mayor thundered, "or we'll all be out of our jobs." And if you can see that, it's the mayor thundering there. So. Suddenly, there was a tapping at the door. In stepped the oddest looking fellow any of the council members had ever seen. He was as tall and as lean as a birch tree, with long, sharp features and bright eyes as blue as sapphires. His clothes were a marvelous patchwork of color, and in his hand he carried a musical pipe. "Who are you?" barked the mayor. "I am only a poor piper," answered the stranger. "But I can pipe music that will charm any living creature. If you will pay me 1,000 guilders, I will get rid of the rats. If you can really do as you say, I'll give you 50,000 guilders, cried the mayor. "Then play I shall," said the piper as he stepped outside. He raised his pipe to his lips, and out came a melody both strange and beautiful. No one had ever heard music quite like it. As the piper piped, out came the rats, big ones and small ones, fat ones and thin ones, till Hamelin's streets were filled with them. The rats followed the piper as he made his way through the town. Well, the people watched in wonder. When the piper came to the bank of the river, he stopped, but continued to play his pipe. The rats, however, did not stop. Into the river they plunged, never to return to the town. Hamelin was free of the vermin at last. The people cheered as the piper made his way back to the town hall. "I've come to collect my 1,000 guilders, he told the mayor. "But I was only joking," said the mayor, chuckling. Now that the rats were gone, he had no further need for the piper. "I'll give you these 50 guilders and nothing more. Now take them and leave." "Then leave I shall," said the piper, "but not before I've played a different tune." And he stepped outside and lifted his pipe once more. As the music began, the pattering of feet could be heard, but this time it was not from the rats. From every corner of Hamelin came the children of the town, hand in hand, dancing and prancing. The children followed the piper as he led them through the town. When the parents recognized their children in the procession, they tried to stop them but could not. The musician had frozen the parents in place like statues. On went the piper and his army of children through the streets and over the bridge that led out of town. The last in line was a little lame boy. The tapping of his cane as he hurried to keep up with the others was the last sound that the stricken townsfolk heard as the children disappeared from view. When they could move again, the townsfolk rushed across the bridge to find the children. Following the road that led from Hamelin, they soon came to a mountain that the children had climbed. There they found the little lame boy in tears. He told them that when the piper and the children had reached this place, a door in the mountain had opened up and everyone had entered. Everyone, that is, except the boy himself. "I could not keep up with the others," he told the grown-up sadly. "The door closed before I could reach it." "Did the piper say where he was taking our children?" someone asked. "Yes," the boy replied, "to a happy land where it is always spring. To a land of flowers and fountains, peacocks and winged horses." The people stood and wept. Some pleaded with the mountain to open. Others shouted for the piper to return, promising that the mayor would pay what was owed him, and more. But the mountain did not open, and the piper did not answer. So, anything to be learned from an odd story like that? Anybody? Yeah, exactly. Anything else comes to mind? Or yeah.
Keep your word.
Yeah. I think that's one of the most important points of that story is keep your word. This all would have been avoided. And it's a fantastical story with fantastical details. But something apparently really did happen, mm-hmm. and nobody knows quite what. Mm-hmm. The historical records are that 130 children of the town of Hamelin somehow left, disappeared, vanished in the 1200s, 1270-something, I believe. And there's records of it. The first records of it is in the 1300s. So something happened. And whatever the case, the people of the town at that point, whatever situation they got themselves into, could do nothing about it. Really kind of a powerful story for a simple lesson. Okay. Here's what one English teacher had to say on the subject of keeping things interesting. Because remember, if you're writing, you're probably writing for the people reading, right? Mm-hmm. Unless it's some therapeutic activity for you. Right? So, the reader doesn't turn the page because of a hunger to applaud. Right? The reader, if you've ever read a really good book, rapt attention, are you thinking, man, this author was a really cool guy, like the whole way through the book? Mm-hmm. Probably not, right? You're thinking about what's making you turn the page is this, you should be in the story, feeling the story, seeing what's going on, that sort of thing. Later you might think, wow, that was a really good author, and look for other books by the same. But the reader doesn't turn the page because of a hunger to applaud mm-hmm. the writer, right? Here are some suggestions for good writing, and we've covered some of these. We'll just kind of go through here. Again, number one, keep it interesting. Life was never meant to be boring, and writing certainly was never meant to be boring. Again, keep it simple, but not simplistic. Necessarily, right? Make sure that it's understandable, so that balance of interesting, captivating, whatever you want to say, but simple. Make it understandable. The third one, keep it original or fresh writing. Right, there is really nothing new under the sun. We all know that. We've borrowed ideas from people all throughout our life. All right. But try to use fresh expressions. There's plenty of ones that we just flat out miss the meaning after a while because they're used so often. And keep it connecting. Remember that good writing is about the reader. So that takes us to consider your audience, right? And think about. In the story, be questions, right, that you're answering as you go along before they've fully answered the questions. Think about your audience. Now, some other things to think of, and this depends a little bit on the type of writing, but give the whole story, especially if you're writing an informative essay or something like that, right? Or you will lose some credibility if an informative essay starts to look like a persuasive one, probably, right? And hone your own natural skills. You don't have to try to write like your favorite writer. Be you, because you can be you better than anybody else. And if you try to be like somebody else too much, now it's good to pull from. Good writers today have, you know, they've taken lessons from good writers of the past. And if you have any, use your humor, right? Now, you don't need to go overboard there, and certainly don't try to crank humor out of a unhumorous situation or something like that. Natural humor, right? Never consider yourself to be a good writer. I said this before. Like anything else, when you think that you've got a handle on it, that's a very, very dangerous place to be, right? Because if you think you have a handle on something or you're good at something, your guard goes down and you become sloppy and boring. Mm-hmm. You certainly have that potential. You're on the brink of it. Work hard and use the best words you can. And again, don't strive to be a good writer. Always strive to be a better writer. And that kind of ties in what we're talking about there before. Now, if you are writing an essay, here are some things just to consider as you write or as you teach about writing, right? So these are not necessarily, here again, if you pick up an English book, you take the CLE, ninth grade, open it up to book 10. You're going to learn how to write an informative or persuasive essay in that light unit. All right? They have a way of going through things in that book that's not necessarily like every other curriculum or every other place you're going to look at the steps. So the exact order is not so important, but here's some ideas, right? So first of all, pick a topic. Now, sometimes a topic's been given to you, and if you're teaching this and you and your students are writing an essay, sometimes I would give them the option to pick one themselves, or I would give them, or sometimes a book had some good ideas. If you are going to let your students pick their topic, which is a good exercise, because if you're writing about something close to you, you're probably going to be more in tune with it and more excited about it. Sometimes it's good to write on a topic given to you. But always have some backup topics readily available to really encourage them to pick their own. So for example, if one of my students would say, just my mind's blank, I can't think of anything to write, there's nothing interesting. Right. Okay. Either you can think of it or I'll pick it for you, right? So why don't you write a persuasive essay on why you think that ontogeny does not recapitulate phylogeny? And then usually their mind snapped into gear and then they had a topic, right? So make sure you have a few of those on hand just in case. Remember to narrow your topic appropriately. Sometimes you can have way, way too much information. One way then, here, this is just an overview, and then I'd like to read a short story of a persuasive nature. It is not intended, it is not expressed that that's what it is, but that's what it is. Bibliography and note cards. Especially in an essay where you're giving information or persuading, you need to keep track of your sources, right? Use trustworthy sources so that you can be a trustworthy source there, right? And you have to reference them, which gets to be a pain, right? And we're not going to learn how to do all of that. But notes are a great way to keep, note cards are a great way to keep track of things in an orderly way. You can take notes on pieces of paper, whatever. Remember to reference your sources. Then prepare your thoughts. And here's, sometimes you can just start writing, jotting down ideas, whatever comes to your mind, if anything, right, down on a piece of paper. At some point you have to organize them, and you can put your title in the middle of the page and have all these bubble clouds, and then you get sidetracked and start drawing things and whatever. Or, you know, you can do an outline, or you have your main points, subpoints, whatever all goes on there. But organize it. At some point here, you have to write your thesis sentence, which includes what is your topic and what is the point of your essay. And then you'll develop from there. And you really have to plan, especially in an argumentative or persuasive essay, you really have to plan your introduction and conclusion well. Right? Because you want to start out with a bang, and you kind of work your way to the middle where it's kind of boring, and then you end with another bang. It's a little bit how that works. A good way to begin a story, essay. Introduce your topic with maybe a short story, quotation, a fact, a question, a statistic, something to grab people's attention and hook them right away. Right? Catch them in the first sentence and definitely in the first paragraph. And your concluding paragraph could very easily be your most important paragraph, because it could very easily be the paragraph that anybody reading what you wrote will remember. Right? You should leave your reader, in some cases, satisfied but with a spinning head, right? Somewhere in there. Right? Something that provokes thought, a challenge, keep their mind going after they're done, or else they're, that was good, done, and they move on, right? So if you really want something to stick, end with something thought-provoking so that it goes around in their mind. And then you actually have to write it and edit it and rewrite it. But that's, you know, like the main body. And we're not going to get into all of that. But those are just some real basic highlights of writing. Now, like I said, this is not stated to be an essay. This is, again, not a completely factual account, all right? But there's a real point here that somebody's trying to get across. And this somebody, in this case, is Mark Twain. And here again, I would not read all of Mark Twain's stories, but here, let's say. But he does have some really good points here, all right? And this is, and probably a lot of you have read this or heard this, The War Prayer. How many of you have read Mark Twain's The War Prayer? Okay. Fewer of you. It was a time of great and exulting excitement. The country was up in arms. The war was on. In every breast burned the holy fire of patriotism. The drums were beating. The bands playing. The toy pistols popping. The bunch firecrackers hissing and sputtering. On every hand and far down the receding and fading spread of roofs and balconies, a fluttering wilderness of flags flashed in the sun. Daily, the young volunteers marched down the wide avenue, gay and fine, in their new uniforms. The proud fathers and mothers and sisters and sweethearts cheering them with voices choked with happy emotion as they swung by. Nightly, the packed mass meetings listened, panting, to patriot oratory which stirred the deepest deeps of their hearts, and which they interrupted at briefest intervals of cyclones of applause, and tears running down their cheeks the while. In the churches, the pastors preached devotion to the flag and country, and invoked the God of battles, beseeching his aid in our good cause in outpourings of fervid eloquence, which moved every listener. It was indeed a glad and gracious time, and the half-dozen rash spirits that ventured to disapprove of the war and cast doubt upon its righteousness straightway got such a stern and angry warning that for their personal safety's sake, they quickly shrank out of sight and offended no more in that way. Sunday morning came. Next day, the battalions would leave for the front. The church was filled. The volunteers were there, their young faces alight. Excuse me. With dreams, visions of the stern advance, the gathering momentum, the rushing charge, the flashing sabers, the flight of the foe, the tumult, the enveloping smoke, the fierce pursuit, the surrender. Then, home from the war, bronzed heroes, welcomed, adored, submerged in golden seas of glory. With the volunteers sat their dear ones, proud, happy, and envied by the neighbors and friends who had no sons and brothers to send forth to the field of honor, there to win for the flag, or, failing, die the noblest of noble deaths. The service proceeded. A war chapter from the Old Testament was read. The first prayer was said. It was followed by an organ burst that shook the building, and with one impulse the house rose with glowing eyes and beating hearts and poured out that tremendous invocation. God, the all-terrible, thou who ordainest, thunder thy clarion and lightning thy sword. Then came the long prayer. None could remember the like of it for passionate pleading and moving and beautiful language. The burden of its supplication was that an ever-merciful and benign Father of us all would watch over our noble young soldiers and aid and comfort and encourage them in their patriotic work. Bless them, shield them in the day of battle and the hour of peril. Bear them in his mighty hand. Make them strong and confident, invincible in the bloody onset. Help them crush the foe, grant to them and their flag and country imperishable honor and glory. An aged stranger entered and moved the slow, noiseless step up the main aisle, his eyes fixed upon the minister, his long body clothed in a robe that reached to his feet. His head bare, his white hair descending in a frothy cataract to his shoulders, his seamy face unnaturally pale, pale even to ghastliness. With all eyes following him and wondering, he made his silent way. Without pausing, he ascended to the preacher's side and stood there waiting. With shut lids, the preacher, unconscious of his presence, continued his moving prayer, and at last finished it with the words uttered in fervent appeal. Bless our arms, grant us a victory, O Lord and God, Father and protector of our land and flag. The stranger touched his arm, motioned him to step aside, which the startled minister did, and took his place. During some moments, he surveyed the spellbound audience with solemn eyes, in which burned an uncanny light. Then, in a deep voice, he said, I come from the throne, bearing a message from Almighty God. The words smote the house with a shock. If the stranger perceived it, he gave no attention. He has heard the prayer of his servant, your shepherd, and will grant it if such be your desire after I, his messenger, shall have explained to you its import. That is to say, its full import. For it is like unto many of the prayers of man, in that it asks for more than he who utters it is aware of, except he pause and think. God's servant and yours has prayed his prayer. He has paused and taken thought. Is it one prayer? No, it is two. One uttered and the other not. Both have reached the ear of him who heareth all supplications, the spoken and the unspoken. Ponder this. Keep it in mind. If you would beseech a blessing upon yourself, beware, lest without intent you invoke a curse upon your neighbor at the same time. If you pray for a blessing of rain on your crop, which needs it, by that act you are possibly praying for a curse on some neighbor's crop, which may not need rain and can be injured by it. You have heard your servant's prayer, the uttered part of it. I am commissioned by God to put into words the other part of it, that part which the pastor and also you in your hearts fervently prayed silently and ignorantly and unthinkingly. God grant that it was so. You heard the words, grant us the victory, O Lord our God. That is sufficient. The whole of the uttered prayer is compact into those words. Elaborations were not necessary. When you have prayed for victory, you have prayed for many unmentioned results which follow victory, must follow it, cannot help but follow it. Upon the listening Spirit of God fell also the unspoken part of the prayer. He commanded me to put it into words. Listen. Lord our Father, our young patriots, idols of our heart, go forth into battle. Be thou near them. In spirit, we also go forth from the sweet peace of our beloved firesides to smite the foe. O Lord our God, help us tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with our shells. Help us to cover their smiling fields with the pale forms of their patriot dead. Help us to drown the thunder of the guns with the shrieks of their wounded writhing in pain. Help us to turn them out roofless, with their little children to wander unfriended in the wastes of their desolated land in rags and hunger and thirst. Sports of the sun flames in summer and the icy winds of winter, broken in spirit, worn with travail, imploring thee for refuge of the grave and denied it. For our sakes who adore thee, Lord, blast their hopes, blight their lives, protract their bitter pilgrimage, make heavy their steps, water their way with tears, stain the white snow with the blood of their wounded at their feet. We ask it in the spirit of love of him who is a source of love, and who is the ever-faithful refuge and friend of all that are sore beset, and seek his aid with humble and contrite hearts. Amen. After a pause, he said, ye have prayed it. If ye still desire it, speak. The messenger of the Most High waits. It was believed afterward that the man was a lunatic, because there was no sense in what he said. So there is, I think that would be, in my mind, that is a persuasive essay. It's not what you normally think. It's not a bunch of things referenced. You know, you don't have this reference page where you go. But it definitely, most certainly, brings out a point that the author wishes to portray. Unless, of course, it makes no sense at all. Also, other very good writing things in there. If you noticed his use of adjectives and of setting up scenes so that you can see and feel just everyday things that we all know and experience, and bringing that alive in some setting. It's the War Prayer of Mark Twain. And I'll just very quickly touch on writing poetry. In all of writing, I would say there are rules to follow for good writing. There are rules to follow for writing poems. There are rules to follow for writing essays. There are rules to follow in writing stories. But sometimes if we stick too close to the script, it gets stuffy. However, if we go too far out of that, we become clumsy. And so there's this kind of this fine line. And I have, I think, an example of this that we're going to close with. But again, if you're teaching poetry, writing poems to your students, start very simple, right, and interesting. I think one of the worst things we could do is, for like the first time that we're introduced to poetry, start writing little marks on top of a line, say, accent, and learn about the feet. And if you have 5 feet, you can be iambic or however you say, I don't even know how you say that, right? With accent, or the other way around, dactyl, right? All these things, we better have been introduced to this earlier. Those are very, very helpful things in really building on writing poetry, right? But first of all, just some really basic rhyming, right? I mean, really basic, maybe, like, you know, I mean, Ben ran to the van, jumped in, sat on a pin, those sorts of things, right? I mean, just real basic, excuse me, simple and interesting. Doesn't even have to follow all the right accents at first, right? Later, we can expand into all of that. And generally, there is a pattern if you go through. And this is one thing where poetry should feel right. It should sound good. Good rhythms should have a pleasing sound and feel. And so if you can kind of cultivate that with good poetry and with working together on a few poems, you're really learning that ahead of time. It's a little bit like you're really learning, if you learn to sing things like Jesus Loves Me when you're little, all right, then at some point you kind of have the beat or the you know, down, whatever beat there is there, but right, you can kind of feel that after a while. And poetry is something you should be able to feel a lot of times here. And again, perfection stifles poetry, but I get driven crazy by things that aren't too close to perfect in poetry. Coloring too far outside of the lines becomes clumsy, and it just doesn't quite feel right. And that's, I have an example here of you probably all know this poem. Maybe not all. It's fine if you don't. Very good. Lots of meaning in here. It's pretty short. It's really packed. And it follows pretty well. There's a little variation. So if you were to give an explanation to somebody of something that rhymes, what would you say? Like if you have a word that rhymes with another word. How would you, or an example of that, how would you go about? What's that?
Cat rhymes with hat.
Okay, cat rhymes with hat, right? It kind of ends the same. Doesn't start the same. It ends the same, right? Well, if you really pay attention to this poem, some of them start the same and end the same. And that's not really, I mean, rhyming, right? But he has a basic flow here where every other line rhymes, right? So if you were to write on the board, which is not very good board access here, but like your A's and B's, if you do that, right? So every verse, it'd be your A, B, A, B, and then, so, you know, like that. With the exception that every word ends rhyming, but some of them are the exact same word, the way he uses it, right? So just listen for that. The other thing is, if you do pay attention to feet and that sort of thing, he's kind of on this every other, where every other line is five full feet, and then every other has an extra unaccented one. So I think this is a really good example. This will do more than me standing up here saying what good poetry is. Right? And that is if, for Rudyard Kipling. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn out tools, if you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss, if you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings, nor lose the common touch. If neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you. If all men count with you, but none too much. If you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run. Yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And, which is more, you'll be a man, my son. Right. Notice the very first three lines ended with you. All three of them, right? But very good. Just a little variation in there. But really good flow and feeling. And it feels good. And there's so much packed into this. Very powerful. So thank you all very much for your attention. And you may be dismissed.